Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for July 16th, mid-July.
We're back
in Binghamton after being gone for quite a long
time. It's been a whirlwind.
World tour,
right.
For me, not for you so much.
I was in Jerusalem in Virginia. You just went to Kenya. That was the only thing you did more than me.
I think we should have our argument.
But in fact, if we were to count up the places.
Yeah, I think we should have our argument about what counts as being in a country. And our listener should
I've been on every continent in the world, except for Antarctica.
But you, some of those have just been by being in the airport and not setting foot on the ground. And
no,
that doesn't count.
No, there's not one that I've only been in. My point is about that is that I have visited both France and Iceland.
The Iceland doesn't count.
It does.
And the France barely counts. You went to a hotel for a few hours, but the Iceland, you walked from the bus.
It doesn't matter. Both are European. I've been to England for 2-3 weeks. So I've been to Europe.
Okay, but I want to be on the record.
I've got Africa, I've got North America, I've got...
You don't have South America.
I don't have South America yet. All it takes is one little plane trip.
I'm just saying, it doesn't count if you don't leave
the
airport.
How many continents have you been to?
3.
Okay, so...
I'm not sure. So I'm not in... First of all, traveling. I'm not in a competition either. I'm just saying, it doesn't count if you don't leave the airport.
It does count. You're in the air. You're actually... Are you in... When the plane lands in Iceland.
You can't brag about having visited that country.
When the plane lands on the tarmac in Iceland, are you then in Iceland or outside of Iceland?
I mean, I'm not going to go around telling people that I was in Iceland.
I had a layover, but
I'm not going to be like, and when I visited Iceland versus when I did spend 4 days in Madrid.
Were you in Iceland?
I was... Definitely in Madrid, and I was there for 4 whole days, and that counts as an actual visiting of Madrid.
I would submit that in both cases, that you were actually in both countries. You're in Iceland.
If you're counting up countries, though, okay. So there's the argument, and we welcome feedback.
Whose
side are you on? Well, no, I mean...
Do you know those little maps that people put on the back of their RVs when they're driving across the country, which states they've been through? If they drive through Kansas, they've been to Kansas. They put their little Kansas thing on it. If they drive through the corner of Rhode Island, they put that on their thing. You don't have to, like, get out of the place and hang out
that's
and have a...
That's stupid.
No, it's not stupid.
You should have to get out and spend a couple of days in order to count that as a visit.
I think you're being ridiculous.
So, I think we could spend the whole hour having this argument. I think we should move on.
I was also upset that I didn't get to go have Iceland stamp my passport.
Leave the airport because you didn't have enough time because you were on WOW Air. Do you have anything you want to say about WOW Air?
Yeah.
Some thoughts.
Wow. Wow. So you have to pay. So it's really cheap.
But you spend all the money that you saved consoling yourself with food and wine and
it's so cheap but you have to pay if you want to carry a bag wherever you're going internationally. You have to pay $16, I think it is, for...
No, I think it was like $23.
Okay, $23 for
a carry-on,
a medium-sized carry-on.
Yes,
right. If you want to put something under the plane, like a big bag, it's like $100.
I thought it was 60 or something.
I don't know, sweetheart. Are you going
to... People are checking out WOW Air, I want them to have real...
You always correct me. That's
what marriage is. That's what marriage covenant is. It's a mutual correction, one of the other.
It was a lot of money to check a bag in, and then... You don't get it. They don't give you anything. If you want water, if you're coming out of the Sahara Desert and you're dying of thirst, they'll ask you to pay for water.
$3 for water.
$3 for water. They don't even give you just water. You know, even like the cheaper airlines in America, they'll just give you a cup of coffee or something, or like...
Yeah.
But they don't do that on WOW Air. And so everything, it ends up costing more because you're right. You're so
like cast down and... And discouraged. and hungry and tired.
You spend lavishly on food.
You overcompensate.
Yeah.
Well, so on my way back from Kenya, I went Royal Air Maroc, which when we did that, whatever, 15, 14 years ago, the bulkhead was shaking back and forth. Mm-hmm. This time the planes were new and nice. Mm-hmm. But the manner, so most of the flight attendants were men. I think there's only maybe two flight attendants on three different legs of flights. And they were very brusque. Like, they were cheerful and smiling, but very like, here's your tray of food. And they would like slap it down. The person next to me was sleeping soundly. And the guy reached over me and shook her till she woke up and asked her if she wanted breakfast. And she looked at him, you know,
shocked,
sadly alarmed, and was like, why would I want breakfast? It was really interesting. The manner was very brusque. I'm not used to that. Now you'll have this kind of, you'll have this now.
Right.
But at least the planes didn't shake. The landings were very good, so I was grateful for that.
Well, I was surprised. I was expecting international flights to have more
death,
more fear, and that all of their flights. See, on my side, they were very smooth.
Yeah,
pretty good landing. I'm terrified of.
Why?
Of flying.
It's so incongruous to me. I don't understand you at all.
Why?
Why would you be?
Because you can't, if the plane crashes, you're going to die.
Well, yeah, but
if your car crashes, you might survive.
You got in the plane, though. Like, didn't you count that cost before you got flying?
No, I know.
On?
I mean, I even though I'm deathly afraid of flying, I do it. Yeah, I wasn't afraid of flying until I started jumping out of airplanes a long time ago. In airborne school, that's where I first got my fear of flying, when I realized just how tenuous the whole thing is.
It is terrible to put yourself into a metal tube.
Yeah.
Hurtle through the sky and, you know, trust yourself to the mercy of people that you haven't really met.
Without a parachute. And I consoled myself while we were doing the map of the earth in airborne school. And afterwards, map of the earth is when the plane, like, rides the geographical features of the earth. So
that's horrible.
Right. So you get desperately sick. But you kind of console yourself by thinking, okay, well, if the plane, you know, catches on fire or just clips the top of a mountain, they'll open the doors and shove us all out so we can jump and maybe live. But you don't get a parachute on WOW Air or on.
They should have parachutes under the seat with the seat back.
Yeah,
pocket.
I agree.
There should be a parachute in there.
Reach under your seat and pull out your parachute.
Yeah,
we're going to die unless you jump back. Or I always thought that they should have planes equipped with parachutes themselves. So the whole plane
Has a parachute.
All the captain has to do is shut off the engine and push a button and boom. Like these parachute
massive
things come out from the wings or from the fuselage and then you just kind of float down gently. I don't know why they don't do that.
Well, if you're shot down by Russia, you don't need a parachute.
But if your engines cease.
Which is what they think happened to that Malaysian flight that disappeared.
They were shot down by Russians.
They think it was shot down by Russians or somebody. They know that like 3 or 4 years later or something. This wasn't going to be what we were going to talk about.
No, we were going to talk about more serious things.
I can't remember what they are now.
We were going to talk about our world travels. You were going to talk about going to Kenya in particular. So.
Yes, I wanted to. Because talk about Kenya.
Our last Preventing Grace podcast, we talked about Jerusalem.
And so we Gathcon. Covered that. We don't need to ever speak of it again.
We shall never speak of that again.
Well, so I went on to Kenya, and particularly to look at a tiny slum school, which right now is just called Kawinda. That's the name of the slum. And we're trying to think of a name for the school. It's a preschool with 23 children right now, although it sometimes has gone up to 40, and a teacher and a cook. And the brilliant thing, okay, so Kawinda is like a 1 mile square slum with maybe 1,000 people living in it. And there are other preschools around, there's a Catholic preschool, a Baptist preschool, and a Presbyterian preschool. So while I was there, I checked out the, I mean, I observed the children of the other preschools in their uniforms, and
right.
Of course, it's good for there to be charitable acts of all kinds, but I did think that our uniforms were much better than those of the Baptists. They could have really spruced up their kids. Their kids are sent home at noon with like a Tupperware of beans. That's what they get to eat. Whereas our children, not to be, you know, in a contest or anything, but our children get a porridge at 10 and then they get a lunch at noon. They are pretty round, I noticed. Like, they were well fed. Our lunch
they didn't
and
look
breakfast.
The pictures you took.
Yeah, we watched them eat lunch. Well, we had a party, so all the parents were invited, and the children sort of sat back in their little plastic chairs eating enormous plates of. I mean, it's not every day that they get meat, but they had it. We had a meat stew and chapatis, and it was like being at a bar. Well,
what's
then we
chapatis?
Gave them. Those are those Indian flatbread. Oh. It's kind of like naan, but not really at all. We gave them soda, and it was like being at a bar. They drank down the soda, and then they leaned back, and they looked just drunk, and were kind of like rolling around. It was the best day. They were like deeply,
do they have
deeply
soda very
happy.
Often? Is it
I don't think they get soda often. Then we handed out candy. It's brilliant. The teacher is really good, and she has a good record. So in Kenya, to get into the first grade, you have to have an interview in which you can prove that you are basically reading already and doing basic math. So the 5-year-old child has...
That seemed like a weird system. Why would they... Isn't kindergarten where you're supposed to learn those things? How would you learn them beforehand? Is it preschool? Is that the idea? Everyone has to have preschool?
Well, no, first grade is like... for age 6, so it's kind of more first grade. So the preschool goes kind of through kindergarten. Like,
so
they're calling
it's a burden
preschool.
On the parents to teach their children how to read before they even go to school.
Well, that's why all these little preschools exist. That's why early education, as you might call it, is so important, especially in the slum, because and I think you can
Speaking
take the interview.
Sorry,
not a dog. What was I saying?
You're saying it was not...
I think you can take the interview again. Like, if you're 7 or something, you can try again.
Until you get in.
Yeah. But to get move along in life and get out of the slum is so great to get an education. It's almost the only thing. And so... And there are tons of children in the slum that we could easily take on many, many more children. And... Well, we can't easily because we don't have enough resources right now, but there were children hanging around doing nothing, older children too, who just can't go to school. So, yeah, it was really great to see what they're doing in this like incredibly poor space. And I was encouraged by how happy the children were in mm-hmm. spite of the sewage running around down.
Yeah, I mean, we took this video of the sewage pipe.
The way that they have to go up to the restroom, that they have an outhouse built just for the children, but it's been damaged by fire. So that's one of the things we want to do is restore and renew the loo and then fix the building up a lot. And they're sitting in the dark. But the thing that impressed me was how cheerful the children are and what good self-control they have, and that's not a thing that you see with American children. Self-control and cheerfulness are not the two properties of children in the West.
You were telling me this and I just had the image of, you know, the American kindergarten person walking through aisles piled with food and candy in the store and having temper tantrums when
right.
he or she doesn't get
right.
what he or she wants, and contrasted with these kids who are, you know, by our standards, utterly impoverished
yes.
and have nothing.
But they have two things that are so valuable, and that's they have self-control and a cheerful spirit.
Which I think you get through not having everything you want over time.
Also through parents being able to parent.
Right.
So the parents who bring their children to this tiny school want an educate, but they are parenting in impossible circumstances. They are teaching, and the teacher goes on teaching self-control and self-mastery. To master the emotions and be able to control the self is such an incredible gift. And it occurred to me as I was there, and doesn't happen to me very often, but the Beatitudes were going through my mind. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And then the list of, in Paul, there's always a long list of virtues, of which self-control is always there, that there's a blessing for the person who has mastery over himself, that there's a kind of happiness in the spirit, that when you don't have control over yourself and your own emotions, particularly, or your mind, there's a deep sadness that sets in. And so if you were going to look at where God's blessing really was, where is God pouring out his blessing? I would have thought that it would have been, say, in my Sunday school rooms here in Binghamton, where I have a great difficulty getting children to come. Like, I it's hard to get parents to bring their children to
Sunday school starts at 9
on a Sunday 15. Morning. Yeah, it's really hard. Whereas this tin shack was full of children whose parents wanted them to know Jesus.
Yeah.
And they had this, what in the Bible says is a blessed thing, a happiness. It was exhibited in who they were. It kind of overturned my own vision.
It's frustrating when I it's innumerable times I can remember just watching a parent stand there helplessly while their child tantrums, not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
The child's emotions are out of control, so I've just got to wait till this storm kind of
breaks.
Whereas, traditionally, your child starts tantruming, the child has something to cry about. because you give the child something to cry about, and then the child learns, okay, it's greater pain for me to tantrum and get the spanking than not to tantrum. So he learns from a very early age to control himself because he doesn't want the worst thing. Right.
But that teaches him that he can control himself.
Yeah, and
it's
a kindness
control
to the child to punish tantruming.
Yeah.
Very early on. So what they learn.
So the child can get a grip over his own self and sort of isn't a slave to himself and his own emotions, which I think we're seeing culturally. It starts really young, but if you look at everyone, me included, I don't think I have really good self-control. There's our truck.
I was watching I know, our truck's here. I was watching this video of a young, not young, but a 12, 13-year-old boy, I think it was, and they were in some Caribbean place having a kind of a tour in a glass-bottom boat, and you could look down, in a glass bottom boat, you can look down and see all the fish, and he was looking down there, and he said, I want to go in. I want to go swimming. It was a kind of a chartered tour.
Mm-hmm.
And the charter people said, well, we can't.
We're not going in.
We don't go swimming on this tour. We just look at the fish. And if you want to go swimming, you go to a different tour. And this 12-year-old boy said, I want to go in. I want to go in the water. And his parents were there, and his parents were, now, Joey or whatever. The gentleman says we can't do that, but he kept amping up, and the temper tantrum couldn't stop, and so he's 13 years old, so he knows some choice language, so he starts cursing these men who wouldn't let him go in the water.
Wow.
And said, you don't know who you're messing with. I can do whatever I want. You can't tell me what to do.
Oh my word.
Finally, it was awesome. I'll find this video. Maybe we can link it. One of the men just threw him over the board. you want to go swimming? Boom. he shoved him in the water. And the dad and mom go, oh, no, don't do that. They're upset. And the kid's upset because he didn't get his swimsuit on. And
he had to be in the water with all his clothes on.
Yeah. So. But you just don't, I mean, other countries don't mess around with.
Well, there was that one video of the, some Asian country, or I don't know, just generalized broadly over an entire section of the world, taking a sledgehammer to his son's Xbox or PlayStation.
Yeah.
And because he broke some kind of rule. I thought this was brilliant. But, and the boy is completely out of control, like, as his father is breaking his most prized possession, which is a good thing to do. He's, like, just screaming. He's maybe 14.
Yeah.
So it's
the helplessness of the American parent before the tantrum.
Well, of the American before his own emotions, even when he's grown up.
Right.
Or his own desires, the thing that he wants now, if he can't have it, he's
or he doesn't know how to control himself, so he pulls out his credit card.
Yeah.
Or he buys it. Here he does it. You know, I just feel like I want this.
So what I wondered as I was there is what is worse than extreme poverty? Because extreme poverty, it's really not nice, and our church really wants to help the teacher and the parents don't want a horrible school for their children. They want safety, and they do want to get out of poverty. Like, Christians should help people get out of material poverty. But there are worse things than material poverty. And, I mean, God says this, and I don't think I have any real grasp of what it means, but a worse thing than material poverty is a heart so hard that you end up in hell.
right.
Which culturally is where we are. We have this collective self love that is made such a deep hardness. We're so at the mercy of ourselves.
Right, because I think the assumption is following the heart is the
best thing.
It's a soft thing. Is the thing that shows you're sensitive to the heart. When you're very right, actually, it's sclerosis. It hardens it.
And it's a cultural thing that's so terrible.
Yeah.
I can see why, say, you know, America doesn't have like a lot of mission. You know, there are fewer and fewer missionaries going abroad. I don't think we have people. We don't need to send people because we don't. We're not in a place of blessing, I might say, and God is. We have so many things that we could do, and that we could be helped by looking, not in a patronizing way, at the rest of the world. Like, how can we spend our money and make your life better? But you actually know something that we don't know anymore. We did once know it, but we've forgotten what it is. Not to aggrandize and nostalgia, because they have incredible corruption. And after we were there, we visited the teacher, and she was, because we visited her, all these, you know, fancy Americans came to her little place, and, you know, she gave us tea, and we had a really nice time at her house. But after that, she was robbed, because people figured that we had probably given her something, and we hadn't. She just invited us to tea, so...
Well, it sounds like, I mean, from what you describe, it sounds like they're just the people are at the mercy of these of thieves and liars, and
the
government won't do anything about it. And
the government is
part of it, right?
Yeah,
part of it, right?
So, yeah, it's not, like a, you know, let's go to Africa and solve our problems or solve theirs,
right?
But I don't know. I think the church should talk to itself.
When you describe it, I can see why, if I were in a country like that, I'd be happy for a strong man to gain power, because...
I know you said that to me, and I don't even understand what you mean. No, you don't want a strong... There is a strong man, and he's taking everybody's money.
Well, no. I mean, but someone who really, like, can actually make the trains run on time and destroy the thieves and the...
The
In a Western context, that's usually what happens to a strong man. You exchange law and justice, law and order, for certain freedoms. And I can see how you might want to do that from a Western context.
And I don't think it's occurred to anybody. There are strong men in Africa, but they don't.
They don't do that.
They don't make the trains run on time. They do kill old people, and like. But efficiency in government isn't one of the things that comes with that.
All right.
Well, so I had a really good visit. I felt like it was productive for my own Christian vision. It was really good. And I grew up in Africa. The thing I've said this over and over again, but Mali is one of the poorest countries in the world. But the poverty of Mali is nothing like one slum in Kenya. Like, it's
right.
And Malians have gone to Kenya to visit my parents, and it's been so horrified by the slums there that, I mean, they were genuinely shocked that any human person would live that way. That's interesting to me, but anyway. So that wasn't the only thing we were going to talk about. What else were we going to talk about? Did you want to talk about the Episcopal Church?
I did.
For some reason? I can't remember.
Well, they just finished their General Convention, which is always a circus. I wish, I actually miss going to the General Conventions because it's so entertaining.
I mean, when you went in 2006, though, you came back a gaunt and broken man. You went looking sort of healthy, and you came back looking emaciated, and the look in your eye was that of a broken person, a broken spirit,
because
that
it was
you've
so,
never recovered. You've never
it was
gotten
so
your...
sick. It was sick, yeah. But it was funny. Funny sick. Like you're looking at...
I don't know.
You're looking at death.
And is it funny? Death funny?
Well, it's ridiculous, not funny. It's ridiculous. I mean, the people are dying. The church is dying, and they're
rearranging.
You know, passing resolutions about, you know, their support of the Palestinian. As if your dying, godless, perverse organization has anything at all to say to the world about anything. it's just ridiculous. So anyway, the Episcopal Church just got finished with its latest conventicle or whatever it is, and they've convention, and they've
these conventicle.
Yeah, I think it's an old word for. Oh. So anyway, they the fear going in was that they were going to push forward a revision of the prayer book, which they apparently didn't do.
Oh, they didn't? I thought they did.
Nope, they've allowed. They push forward alternative rites, but
okay, I wasn't actually paying attention. So I will say nothing more now.
Yeah, the big thing was I guess not the big, the only big thing, but the biggest thing was, excuse me, pushing through B0112, which originally said that bishops in Orthodox dioceses no longer can forbid congregations that are heretical from having same-sex blessings or marriages in their if a congregation in an Orthodox diocese wants to go forward with that, the bishop can't say no. And it was just going to be pushed through like that. But then the bishops got together, the House of Deputies approved that one, but the bishops got together and said, okay, well, let's also, if a bishop has conscientious issues, is conscientiously opposed to this, let's allow that congregation to have depot, which is alternative episcopal oversight. So another bishop would then oversee that parish, and it wouldn't be the responsibility of the actual bishop of the diocese. And then the communion partner bishops, who are more or less Orthodox bishops in the Episcopal Church, issued a statement about how wonderful the whole thing was. I mean, it's just... there are people I know in the Episcopal Church who are faithful. There are churches that are faithful and have integrity, but I've always thought the communion partner bishops were the most...
Choose your words carefully, man. Choose your words.
Well, they're gutless.
Okay, that's not what I thought you should say.
Cowardly?
No.
Weak?
No.
Confused? Theologically confused? Okay.
Maybe, I don't know. Just try not to be a jerk. Just try not to be a jerk.
Well, in the statement they say, oh, well, you know, I'll read the quote. You know, they'd say, okay, well, we affirm the marriage between a man and a woman, the Bible teaches that, da-da-da-da. But we recognize that other Christians of goodwill and commitment hold contrasting convictions about marriage. No. No, other Christians of goodwill and commitment do not, other Christians of goodwill and commitment do not hold contrasting convictions about marriage. Just like Christians of good commitment and will do not hold contrasting visions about, or versions of the Trinity, or contrasting ideas about the dual natures of Christ, or contrasting ideas about what the gospel. No, this is an essential issue. It's not something that we just, well, you know, some Christians drink wine, some don't, some, you know, some watch rated R movies and some don't. This is an essential issue, and it's the Bible's not unclear about it. Marriage is about the gospel. So you compromise it, you're not a Christian. You teach otherwise, you're not a Christian. I'm not talking about your eternal salvation here. You might go to heaven. I'm talking about your membership in the body of Christ visible. When you compromise an essential doctrine, you're not a Christian of goodwill. You're an apostate. Now, I'll let God sort out whether or not he's going to bring you to repentance. And
well, that's
and
nice of you.
Thank
you for that.
You're welcome. But but you're not a Christian. I don't see how... what's difficult about this? I don't see why it's difficult to say, okay, you have now blasphemed God's institution of marriage, and you're leading people to hell, but you're a Christian of good commitment and will. No, you're not. it's such a massive disconnect and confusion. I know what they're trying to say. They're trying to say, these people know Jesus. I don't know that that's true, but they don't make the distinction between visible and invisible, between the church and personal faith.
I think that, yeah, because I think, but, I mean, the Episcopal Church, but it's happening in evangelicalism in a wider sense. Christianity is largely about what you feel about God, you know, your feelings about God and the church. And so if you feel like somebody's a Christian, or you yourself feel like a Christian, then that's all that's required.
Arius,
you know,
felt like a Christian.
Yeah, you don't have to... The details and, you know, the trials of actual doctrine and actual objective biblical truth aren't, that compelling. And so it's not very nice of you to cut people out.
I remember listening to Cory Bockham say, or not listening to him, I read... Well, I look at in the eyes of Tara of Shannon Johnson, and you know, I know that he knows the same Jesus I know. No, you don't know that. That's your subjective feeling about a guy who you have a friendship with, but he actually, this Shannon Johnson has betrayed Christ and is leading people to hell, and he's a wolf, and you're befriending him. No. I don't. I'm sorry.
You have so many thoughts and feelings about this.
I do.
You're having all the feels.
So this agreement, like if you're a bit, so let's put yourself in the position of a bishop over a diocese. God has given you responsibility over the people of that diocese to care for them and to keep them from evil and to give them good things, right? That's your pastoral duty. Allowing another bishop to come in and shepherd, quote unquote, one of your congregations to hell is not a good deal. It's not a good compromise. It doesn't keep you from having some kind of conscious issue. You have abdicated your responsibility to care for that congregation and lead them in the gospel. It's one thing to say, all right, we're two different religions here. I'm going to support the Christian faith, and if this congregation doesn't want to be a Christian congregation, then okay, you go be a heretic congregation, and that's one thing. But that's not what they're saying. They're saying, I'm going to let this other Christian bishop come in and take care of this Christian congregation.
They're using the word Christian too broadly.
Yeah.
But if you did that, if you actually said that those other bishops were no longer within the realm of Christianity, wouldn't you have to get out?
We're doing that in GAFCON. We're doing that on a worldwide scale on GAFCON. We're saying, look, the Episcopal Church is made up of people who are not Christians. But Nigeria and Kenya still remains in the Anglican Communion, and they're and Uganda and all the others of the Global South, and they're just creating alternate structures. We have to mess with them.
Right,
but they're saying the words, the right words. These are not believers. These are wolves. These are heretics.
If you were a communion partner, though, like in the, if you're in tech and you believe in the gospel, then you really thought the other bishops of tech who do not believe in the gospel did not believe in the gospel. You wouldn't be able to be in real communion with them.
Not communion, but you'd be able to stay in the same institution.
Yeah. Okay.
So you could, I wouldn't take communion with them. I wouldn't allow them to preach or teach in my churches or...
But you could remain institutionally... Institutionally,
people do that. They just say, okay, well, you're not a Christian. But I'm not
This is where I think some evangelicals look askance at Anglicanism and wonder, how is that possible? Why would you be... institutionally connected to somebody who's not a Christian if it's supposedly a Christian thing.
Well, I don't think you should. I mean, I wouldn't do that, but I'm saying I can see how it's possible. I mean, you can, if you think that you could restore the denomination.
Right.
It's kind of what the Reformers were trying to do.
Luther wasn't saying, let's
make a new church. And
that's true. He wasn't trying to get out.
Right.
He was chucked out.
Right. So that's So I don't think it's a bad thing to do. If there comes a point where, as a pastor, you might have to leave. Like if we did it, I mean, I think the fundamental calculus on our part was, if we die, then the bishop will turn Good Shepherd into a mission, and he'll put his own guy in, and that will be it. So we had to figure out a way to keep our congregation safe.
Yeah.
But. So, I mean, I think it's worse for pastors in the Episcopal Church than it is for people, but still, I think it's possible to make that, to stay in some cases, but don't stay like these guys do. I mean, don't compromise your language, don't compromise the gospel because you want to be friends with these other bishops, and it's ridiculous.
Well, now that you've said all those things, your hair is standing completely on end. you look... totally crazed. What was the other thing we were going to talk about?
I don't remember.
Did you want to talk about the judges? I can't remember. We have a news.
Yeah. Okay. So no one who listens to this podcast will think that we're Trump fans. In fact, I would probably categorize myself still as an ever-Trumper because I won't vote for him because he's not a faithful person and he's not honest. But I have to say, he's done well as far as, the economy seems to be going well, and for the first time in decades, we have an opportunity to make some kind of legal dent in Roe v. Wade, which is great. And if only Ginsburg would retire.
Is that what you were going to say?
Yes, that was what I was going to say. then we would have a real opportunity to overturn the mass slaughter of innocent people in our country, which would be great.
If that actually happened, I think it would be really funny that it happened under Trump.
It would be funny.
I mean, I don't know what it would mean, but in a sort of a cosmic joking sense, I think it would be really funny.
Yeah. Well, all we need to do is that we just need someone to challenge abortion at some state level and bring it all the way to the Supreme Court and have...
That's all.
Yeah, well, it didn't. You just pick a case. There's just lots of cases out there. You just pick the right one that could challenge Roe v. Wade and bring it to the Supreme Court. And then if the Supreme Court hears it, you've got an opportunity. I'm not saying it's a slam dunk. It's just a real opportunity to get it done. What are you
thinking? I don't know. You speak with such confidence, like you know exactly.
I happen to have read a lot about this stuff.
Okay.
It's not.
It's more your tone.
It's what liberals do all the time. Liberals do this all the time. They find a case that challenges a case.
Yes, that's true.
And they push it. They get a lot of money behind the case, and they push it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So that's all we have to do. Get it in reverse.
That'll be fine. I look forward to that. I wasn't paying attention. I enjoyed being essentially unplugged for much of the last month. And not knowing what happened at General Convention, and not knowing what happened at the Supreme Court, and not knowing what was going on with immigration. And the sadness for me, the true sadness, was that I missed the entirety of the World Cup. I missed the whole thing. And we kept cable so that I would be able to watch the World Cup, and then I wasn't here, and then the final was on Sunday, and so I missed everything.
Yeah.
Everything. So.
That was too bad. I actually wanted to watch the final. Some faithful parishioners came to the 8 o'clock service yesterday because they knew they were going to go to the 11, to watch, to soccer watching party. And so they actually came to church.
Yes, they came to church.
The game started at 11 a.m., and so I was kind of worried that no one would be there. Yeah. It's actually a pretty good turnout for summer, for the middle of summer. So.
People came. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know how I feel about France winning the whole thing. I kind of wanted Croatia to win.
Well, they got to win something sometimes, France. When it comes to, like, actual battles, they don't do so well. But when,
when it comes to the You're game. Such a horrible chauvinist. Really. With all of the things. Yes.
So, I'm glad that... Mm-hmm. I actually want Croatia to win there, because they're...
Yeah, that would have been really cool.
An underdog, aren't they?
Well, and I really hope someday to visit Croatia. I really want to go there. And
is this because of that book you've been reading for 16 years?
Yeah. I really want to see Diocletian's Palace. Desperately. I want to wander around the Balkans with my huge copy of Black Lamb, Grey Falcon tucked under my arm, reading out passages as I come across different pieces of scenery. That's my life's dream.
Maybe one day we'll be able to go there.
We should take the children on that kind of holiday.
To Croatia?
Yeah, with me and my book, so that I make them stop and look at the landscape while I read the relevant portion. And then we can carry
Sorry,
on.
Sorry, kids, we can't go to Jerusalem
or anywhere.
France or to England.
We're just going
to go to Croatia so your mother can indulge her literary.
Read this book out loud. I know it's like 15,000 pages or something. I don't know how many pages it is.
I can see the look on Aiden's face while you're doing that, too.
Yeah. I insisted on reading a poem for Emma at her birthday.
You
and
say that Emma's turned 16, which is...
Yeah.
Great. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I noticed that the room fell silent as I read the poem. And the interest of all people waned.
It was respectful quiet.
Respectful quiet. I thought she
When will mother stop reading this?
When will mother stop reading this horrible poem? Yes. No, our oldest child is 16. I've been saying it all over the place. I'm kind of unmoored by the whole thing. But, I mean, it's better than her not turning 16.
No, I suppose that's
given
true.
The alternative.
She is actually growing.
It's better for her
not
to...
alive.
Yeah,
right?
As me, myself, it's better
so
for me to have
So we succeeded in making her live and keeping her alive.
Yeah. Obviously. It's better to have a birthday than not have one, but it's...
Her life is contiguous with our time at Good Shepherd.
Yeah.
So we know how long we've been at Good Shepherd by how old she is. She was born... the month after we got here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we've been here for 16 years. Mm-hmm. Which is a long time to
it
be
is.
In one church.
It is. It's a long time, but I like
Let's Good have Shepherd. A moment of silence.
I love Good Shepherd, though. I don't want to leave it.
Well, it's interesting that the kinds of things you know at the 10-year point are very, very different things than you know and experience at the... when you go past that. It's not really 10 years. It's really 7-year increments. You know, like, there's a certain cycle of that you go through.
Yeah.
You know, well, we had the sort of internal, or no, the external fighting against the Episcopal Church for the first 7 years, and then the second 7 years was really more...
internal fighting.
Well, not fighting, but learning how
we
to
had
exercise
discipline. Yeah.
Church discipline.
Yeah.
And... I don't know what this next 7 years is all about.
It's going to be this going to be the cake and the feast.
Oh, it's going to be the cake? Is that what we're eating right now? We're
yeah.
eating this, we're eating cake?
It's going to be the deep joy and happiness.
And then
years.
What do you die after that? Like,
well, no, then it keeps getting better.
It just keeps getting better.
Sorry, that was our 16-year-old daughter asking us about towels.
Yeah.
So we should...
Silently.
Yeah.
I feel like we should move on with the day.
Yeah, we've been talking for too long.
But we've covered the whole gamut, so now we're caught up, and we can resume our podcast about nothing next week.
Right.
Where we just talk about...
our method. Our method is 5 minutes before the podcast starts. We say, what are we going to talk about?
What are we going to talk about? And often it is nothing.
And then we argue for a while about what we're talking about.
Festivus, Seinfeld podcast. Yeah. Podcast about nothing.
Right. So it takes a lot of work to put this forward.
It really does. it's a labor of love. Well, anyway, thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.